Chapter 11. Folly of my kind. For my part, I had never believed that Neve had sold the collection, because he'd found it out, and within a year my incredulity was justified. As soon as the things were put in circulation, they were known for the marvels they are. There was hardly a poor bit in the lot, and my wonder grew at Neve's madness. All over Europe, dealers began to be fighting for the spoils, and all kinds of stuff were palmed off on the unsuspecting as fragments of the Daunt collection. Meanwhile, what was Neve doing? For a long time I didn't hear, and chance kept me from returning to Rome. But one day, in Paris, I ran across a dealer who had captured for a song one of the best Florentine bronzes in the Daunt collection, a marvelous plaquette of Donatello's. I asked him what had become of it, and he said with a grin, "I sold it the other day," naming a price that staggered me. "Ye gods! Who paid you that for it?" His grin broadened, and he answered, "Neve." "Neve? Humphrey Neve? Didn't you know he was buying back his things?" "Nonsense. He is, though. Not in his own name, but he's doing it. And he was, do you know, and at prices that would have made a sane man shudder." A few weeks later I ran across his tracks in London, where he was trying to get hold of a Pennycod enamel, another of his scattered treasures. Then I hunted him down at his hotel, and had it out with him. "Look here, Neve, what are you up to?" He wouldn't tell me at first. Stared and laughed and denied. But I took him off to dine, and after dinner, while we smoked, I happened to mention casually that I had a pull over the man who had the Pennycod, and at that he broke down and confessed. "Yes, I'm buying them back, Finny, it's true." He laughed nervously, twitching his mustache. And then he let me have the story. You know how I'd hungered and thirsted for the real thing. You quoted my own phrase to me once, about the ripe sphere of beauty. So when I got my money, and Don lost his, almost at the same moment, I saw the hand of Providence in it. I knew that, even if I'd been younger, and had more time, I could never hope, nowadays, to form such a collection as that. There was the ripe sphere, within reach, and I took it. But when I got it, and began to live with it, I found out my mistake. It was a marriage to convenience. There had been no wooing, no winning. Each of my little old bits, the rubbish I chucked out to make room for Daunt's glories, had its own personal history, the drama of my relation to it, of the discovery, the struggle, the capture, the first divine moment of possession. There was a romantic secret between us. And then I had absorbed its beauties one by one. They had become a part of my imagination. They held me by a hundred threads of far-reaching association. And suddenly I had expected to create this kind of intense personal tie between myself and a roomful of new cold alien presences, things staring at me vacantly from the depths of unknown pasts. Can you fancy a more preposterous hope? Why, my other things, my own things, had wooed me as passionately as I wooed them. There was a certain little bronze, a little Venus Callipich, who had drawn me, imploring me to rescue her from her unspeakable surroundings, in a vulgar bric-a-brac shop at Biarritz, where she shrank out of sight among sham severs and Dutch silver, as one has seen certain women, rare, shy, exquisite, made almost invisible by the vulgar splendors surrounding them. Well, that little Venus, who was just a specious 17th century attempt at the antique, but who had penetrated me with her pleading grace, touched me by the easily guessed story of her obscure, anonymous origin, was more to me imaginatively, yes, more than the cold-bought beauty of the Daunt Diana. The Daunt Diana. I broke in. "Hold up, Neve, the Daunt Diana?" He smiled contemptuously. A professional beauty, my dear fellow, expected every head to be turned when she came into a room. "Oh, Neve," I groaned. "Yes, I know. You're thinking of what we felt that day we first saw her in London. Many a poor devil has sold his soul as the result of such a first sight. Well, I sold her instead. Do you want the truth about her?" Let it be a blur. He laughed, and stood up with a little shrug of disenchantment. And so you're impenitent? I paused. And yet you're buying some of the things back? Neve laughed again, ironically. I knew you'd find me out, and call me to account. Well, yes. I'm buying back. He stood before me half sheepish, half defiant. I'm buying back, because there's nothing else as good in the market. And because I've a queer feeling that, this time, they'll be mine. But I'm ruining myself at the game, he confessed. It was true. Neve was ruining himself. And he's gone on ruining himself ever since, till now the job's nearly done. Bit by bit, year by year, he has gathered in his scattered treasures, at higher prices than the dealers ever dreamed of getting. There are fabulous details in the story of his quest. Now and then I ran across him, and was able to help him recover a fragment. And it was wonderful, to see his delight in the moment of reunion. Finally, about 2 years ago, we met in Paris, and he told me he had got back all the important pieces except the Diana. The Diana? But you told me you didn't care for her. Didn't care? He leaned across the restaurant table that divided us. Well, no, in a sense I didn't. I wanted her to want me, you see, and she didn't then. Whereas now she's crying to me to come to her. You know where she is? He broke off. Yes, I knew. In the center of Mrs. Willie P. Goldmark's yellow and gold drawing room, under a 1,000 candle power chandelier, with reflectors aimed at her from every point of the compass. I had seen her wincing and shivering there in her outraged nudity at one of the Goldmark rushes. But you can't get her, Neve, I objected. No, I can't get her, he said. Well, last month I was in Rome, for the first time in 6 or 7 years, and of course I looked about for Neve. The Palazzo Neve was let to some rich Russians, and the splendid new porter didn't know where the proprietor lived. But I got on his trail easily enough, and it led me to a strange old place in the Trastevere, an ancient, creviced black palace-turned-tenement house, and fluttering with pauper clotheslines. I found Neve under the leads, in 2 or 3 cold rooms that smelt of the cuisine of all his neighbors. A poor shrunken little figure, seedier and shabbier than ever, yet more alive than when we had made the tour of his collection in the Palazzo Neve. The collection was around him again, not displayed in tall cabinets and on marble tables, but huddled on shelves, perched on chairs, crammed in corners, putting the gleam of bronze, the opalescence of old glass, the pale luster of marble, into all the angles of his low dim rooms. There they were, the proud presences, that had stared at him down the vistas of Daunt House, and shone in cold transplanted beauty under his own painted cornices. There they were, gathered in humble promiscuity about his bent shabby figure, like superb wild creatures tamed to become the familiars of some harmless old wizard. As we went from bit to bit, as he lifted one piece after another, and held it to the light of his low windows, I saw in his hands the same tremor of sensation that I had noticed when he first examined the same objects at Daunt House. All his life was in his fingertips, and it seemed to communicate life to the exquisite things he touched. But you'll think me infected by his mysticism if I tell you they gained new beauty while he held them. We went the round slowly and reverently, and then, when I supposed our inspection was over and was turning to take my leave, he opened a door I had not noticed and showed me into a slit of a room beyond. It was a mere monastic cell, scarcely large enough for his narrow iron bed, and the chest which probably held his few clothes. But there, in a niche of the bare wall, facing the foot of the bed there stood the Daunt Diana. I gasped at the sight and turned to him, and he looked back at me without speaking. In the name of magic, Neve, how did you do it? He smiled as if from the depths of some secret rapture. See, call it magic, if you like, but I ruined myself doing it, he said. I stared at him in silence, breathless with the madness and the wonder of it, and suddenly, red to the ears, He flung out his boyish confession. I lied to you that day in London, the day I said I didn't care for her. I always cared, always worshipped, always wanted her. But she wasn't mine then, and I knew it, and she knew it. And now at last we understand each other. He looked at me shyly, and then glanced about the bare cold cell. The setting isn't worthy of her, I know. She was meant for glories I can't give her. But beautiful things, my dear Finny, like beautiful spirits, live in houses not made with hands. His face shone with extraordinary sweetness as he spoke, and I saw he'd got hold of the secret we're all after. No, the setting isn't worthy of her, if you like. The rooms are as shabby and mean as those we used to see him in years ago over the wine shop. I'm not sure they're not shabbier and meaner. But she rules there at last, she shines and hovers there above him, and there at night, I doubt not, steals down from her cloud to give him the Latmian kiss. The debt, you remember it's not so long ago the talk there was about Dredge's rival of the fittest? The talk has subsided, but the book of course remains. Stands up, in fact, as the tallest thing of its kind since, well, I'd almost said, since the origin of species. I'm not wrong, at any rate, in calling it the most important contribution yet made to the development of the Darwinian theory, or rather to the solution of the awkward problem about which that theory has had to make such a circuit. Dredge's hypothesis will be contested, may one day be disproved. But at least it has swept out of the way all previous conjectures, including of course Lanfear's magnificent attempt, and for our generation of scientific investigators it will serve as the first safe bridge across a murderous black whirlpool. It's all very interesting. There are few things more stirring to the imagination than that sudden projection of the new hypothesis, light as a cobweb and strong as steel, across the intellectual abyss. But, for an idle observer of human motives, the other, the personal, side of Dredge's case is even more interesting and arresting. Personal side? You didn't know there was one? Picture them simply as a thinking machine, a highly specialized instrument of precision, the result of a long series of adaptations, as his own jargon would put it? Well, I don't wonder, if you've met him. He does give the impression of being something out of his own laboratory. A delicate scientific instrument that reveals wonders to the initiated, and is absolutely useless in an ordinary hand. In his youth it was just the other way. I knew him 20 years ago, as an awkward lout whom young Archie Lanfear had picked up at college, and brought home for a visit. I happened to be staying at the Lanfears when the boys arrived, and I shall never forget Dredge's first appearance on the scene. You know the Lanfears always lived very simply. That summer they had gone to Buzzards Bay, in order that Professor Lanfear might be near the biological station at Woods Hall, and they were picnicking in a kind of sketchy bungalow without any attempt at elegance. But Galen Dredge couldn't have been more awestruck if he'd been suddenly plunged into a Fifth Avenue ballroom. He nearly knocked his shock head against the low doorway, and in dodging this peril trod heavily on Mabel Lanfear's foot, and became hopelessly entangled in her mother's draperies, though how he managed it I never knew, for Mrs. Lanfear's dowdy muslins ran to no excess of train. When the professor himself came, in it was 10 times worse, and I saw then that Dredge's emotion was a tribute to the great man's proximity. That made the boy interesting, and I began to watch. Archie, always enthusiastic but vague, had said, "Oh, he's a tremendous chap, you'll see," but I hadn't expected to see quite so clearly. Lanfear's vision, of course, was sharper than mine. And the next morning he had carried Dredge off to the biological station. And that was the way it began. Dredge is the son of a Baptist minister. He comes from East Leith, New York State, and was working his way through college waiting at White Mountain Hotels in summer, when Archie Lanfear ran across him. There were 8 children in the family, and the mother was an invalid. Dredge never had a penny from his father, after he was 14. but his mother wanted him to be a scholar, and tempted him, as he put it, in the hope of his going back to each school at East Leith. He developed slowly, as the scientific mind generally does, and was still adrift about himself and his tendencies, when Archie took him down to Buzzard's Bay. But he had read Lanfear's Utility and Variation, and had always been a patient and curious observer of nature. And his first meeting with Lanfear explained him to himself. It didn't, however, enable him to explain himself to others, and for a long time he remained, to all but Lanfear, an object of incredulity and conjecture. Why, my husband wants him about poor Mrs. Lanfear, the kindest of women, privately lamented to her friends, for Dredge, at that time they kept him all summer at the bungalow, had one of the most encumbering personalities you can imagine. He was as inexpressive as he is today, and yet oddly obtrusive. One of those uncomfortable presences whose silence is an interruption. The poor Lanfears almost died of him that summer, and the pity of it was that he never suspected it, but continued to lavish on them a floundering devotion as uncomfortable as the endearments of a dripping dog, all out of gratitude for the professor's kindness. He was full, in those days, of raw enthusiasms, which he forced on anyone who would listen when his first shyness had worn off. You can't picture him spouting sentimental poetry, can you? Yet I've seen him petrify a whole group of Mrs. Lanfear's callers by suddenly discharging on them, in the strident drawl of Western New York, Barbara Frietchier, he Queen of the May. His taste in literature was uniformly bad, but very definite, and far more assertive than his views on biological questions. In his scientific judgments he showed, even then, a remarkable temperance, a precocious openness to the opposite view, but in literature he was a furious propagandist, aggressive, disputatious, and extremely sensitive to adverse opinion. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.